This morning's message, God Saved the Best for Last, was brought to us by Justin Donner. He and his wife, Alicia, are missionaries in Germany supported by our congregation. The reading is John 2, 1 through 11. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink, but you have saved the best till now." What Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him.
Good morning. That was a very cute video. We just heard the story of the very first miracle Jesus performs in the Gospel of John. He is attending a wedding in the small village of Cana, and he changes water into wine. At first, I have to be honest, that miracle seems almost a little trivial. Jesus is not bringing a young child back to life to comfort his grieving mother. Jesus is not casting out demons. Jesus is not feeding a crowd. He is simply saving a young couple from embarrassment. It doesn't seem like a major issue. It doesn't seem like a situation where you would expect Jesus to use his divine power. Simply, this is an embarrassing situation for the young couple, and Jesus decides to help them. So why does Jesus make this effort to transform water into wine? John himself gives us the answer explicitly and says this was the first of his signs that he did at Cana in Galilee, and he manifested his glory. A lot of what I'm going to be saying about this passage, I have learned from a French commentator whose name is Xavier Léon Dufour. And one of the first points that he makes in his commentary on the book of John, when he is mentioning this passage, is he suggests another translation. He says, John is not simply saying that this is the first time Jesus performs a miracle chronologically. The word in Greek could be translated prototype. This is the model of all of Jesus' miracles. This is the prototype. The first time he does it chronologically, yes, but also this miracle sets the tone for everything else Jesus is going to do in the Gospel of John. John is telling us this story because he wants us to understand something about Jesus' ministry. This is not simply a display of Jesus' divine power. Jesus, I tell this to the teenagers at church when we study miracles, Jesus is not simply showing off. He's not talking to the disciples and saying, "Hey, look what I can do." And he changes water into wine. He is trying to communicate something. He is trying to explain something. The miracles are almost like a visible form of a parable. They're supposed to illustrate something. They're supposed to manifest something about Jesus, manifest his glory that is maybe not obvious to his disciples. If Jesus simply wanted to show off his power, he could speak to a mountain and throw it into the sea. He could walk into Jerusalem, snap his fingers, and hold all the Jews 6 feet in the air and tell them, I will only let you down when you believe in me. Jesus has that power, but that's not what he's trying to do here. He is trying to show something to his disciples. And John, this is something preachers mention very often. John doesn't use the word miracle in this passage or in the rest of the gospel. He uses the word sign. Jesus performs miraculous signs. The idea is, a sign is not simply something miraculous. A sign has a signification. A sign has a meaning. A sign points to something that is greater than itself. It's like a sign when you're driving on the street. The sign points to something else. If you were to come to Germany and you were driving towards the city of Cologne, where Alicia and I live, you would eventually meet this sign. This is a sign letting you know that you are driving towards the Cologne Cathedral, which is a World Heritage Site. Now, you may see that sign and think, oh, great, I've arrived in Cologne, and park on the side of the freeway and get out and look for the cathedral. But that would not be the right thing to do. At that point, you're still about 20 or 30 kilometers outside of Cologne. The sign is not the reality itself. The sign points to something that it's trying to illustrate. The sign is pointing to something that is greater than itself. In this case, the cathedral. And so when you look at a sign in the Gospel of John, it's the same thing. You have to look beyond the appearance. You have to look to what Jesus and John are trying to illustrate through this sign. You have to look for a deeper meaning. In the Gospel of John, there's always several layers in the story. And the most, the top layer is simply the story itself. And that's already an interesting thing to study. But we can always look at the gospel and dig deeper and find spiritual meaning to what John is telling us. For example, in the Gospel of John, Jesus raises his friend Lazarus from the dead later in chapter 11. Once again, this is not simply a display of Jesus' divine power. Jesus is trying to communicate something to his disciples. In this case, in John chapter 11, he tells them, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. The point of the miracle is not simply to admire Jesus' power. The point of the miracle is to understand what he is trying to tell us. It's to understand what he is trying to illustrate with this miracle. And Xavier Léon Dufour, this commentator, says, if you look at the miracle and you do not find the deeper meaning, then you have not understood the miracle in the first place. So when we read this passage, we have to remember that Jesus is doing this in order to explain something, to illustrate something for the disciples. He is trying to communicate. It's a form of teaching that he is doing here. So we are in the small village of Cana. That's in Galilee. It's about 15 kilometers north of Nazareth. You have it on the map. Jesus goes to Cana with his mother and his disciples to attend a wedding. At the time in Israel, a wedding would be the biggest event in your life. Picture a wedding, a wedding party that lasts several days, sometimes up to a week. And that must have been hard for the newlyweds. After a few days, listen, guys, it's not that I don't enjoy spending time with you, but I'd like to spend time with my wife. But this is how weddings happened back then. You would celebrate this event for days and days and days because it was the defining event of your life. And so running out of wine for the biggest party in your life is not simply embarrassing, it's a catastrophe. This couple have been embarrassed in front of not only their families, but their whole village, all their friends, all the people who know them. Verse 3, when the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." It's hard to understand what Mary is wanting Jesus to do. What does she expect him to do? I would not expect Jesus to simply perform a miracle in this case. In fact, Mary doesn't even seem to ask anything of Jesus. She just mentions to him what the situation is. She simply says, "How embarrassing, this poor couple. They have no wine left for their wedding." On a superficial level, that's what Mary is doing. She is simply communicating, describing the situation to Jesus. On a symbolic level, Mary, without knowing it, is expressing the hopes of the people of Israel. She is expressing the desire of Israel to see the reign of the Messiah established. Wine in the Old Testament was often used by the prophets as a symbol of joy, and in particular, the joy of God's people when God intervenes, when God steps down to help his people, when God steps down to save them. And over time, it became a symbol of this hope that Israel had in the coming of the Messiah. The Messiah was going to bring a joy to God's people that they had never experienced. And I wrote a few passages on the PowerPoint. The Messiah was going to bring an overabundance of wine. This is not simply the prophets talking about a giant party. What they are promising is an overabundance of joy for God's people. Joel chapter 3, "In that day the mountains will drip sweet wine, the hills shall flow with milk." Amos chapter 9, "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, where the mountains shall drip sweet wine, all the hills shall flow with it. For how great is the Lord's goodness, says Zechariah, how great his beauty, grain shall make the young men flourish, new wine the young women." We're not talking about a few bottles of wine. The prophets are talking about wine that overflows, wine that flows down the hills and the mountains like rainwater. This was the hope of Israel, that the Messiah would bring the fulfillment of all their hopes, that he would fill their hearts with joy. Without knowing it, Mary is referring to that image. She is simply saying this couple have run out of wine, but in fact, in a spiritual sense, she is saying the people of Israel have also run out of wine. They have run out of hope. They have run out of this joy that they are thirsting for. Without realizing it, Mary is expressing a spiritual need. She is expressing a need for God to step in and save his people. She thinks of real wine. She thinks of the drink. Jesus sees the spiritual need of his people. Jesus sees beyond the appearances. And he understands that this event is an opportunity for him to show what joy he is going to bring his people. Verse 4. I can get that. Excuse me, I skipped a slide. That is Mary asking Jesus for help. Verse 4. Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." This is a very difficult verse. This is a verse that Christians and even commentators have struggled with for centuries. Jesus almost seems to push his mother away and refuse to help her. And I know if I had spoken that way to my mother, I would not be preaching here today. I think it's helpful for us to look at the way John originally phrased this answer of Jesus's. I think the translation here is something translators struggle with. It's hard to very clearly say in English what Jesus is saying. First of all, The phrase that Jesus tells his mother literally is, what is there between you and me? What stands between you and me? And this translation is pretty good. What does this have to do with me? But one translation that's been suggested is, woman, we are not on the same wavelength. Jesus is not simply saying, leave me alone. This has nothing to do with me. He is saying, Mary, you do not understand what you're talking about. He's not pushing her away. He is telling her, watch closely because something important is about to happen. And then this really blew me away when I read it. Xavier Léon Dufour, that commentator, mentions that the second sentence is also one that he thinks has been mistranslated a lot. So in Greek, sorry, I'm a grammar nerd. I'm going to go into grammatical explanation. In Greek, the original manuscripts have no capitals, no lowercase letters, no punctuation. They're just no spaces. They're just letters one after another. And so in order to read the original Greek text, you would have to read it out loud and kind of, from context, guess where one word ends and the next one begins. And so when we read our modern Bibles, a lot of the punctuation is simply choices that the translators have made. They look at the text and they deduce, okay, this phrase, this sentence here is a question, this one is a statement, etc. In most cases, this is a fairly easy job. A lot of the questions have interrogative words. Who, what, where, etc. And so it's very easy to know that there are questions. In other cases, there's no visible difference between a statement and a question. Nowadays, we would just have a question mark at the end of the sentence, and that would be obvious. But back then, the reader was supposed to know whether it was a question or not from context. And so this doesn't happen very often, but there's a few verses where it's difficult to know whether or not a sentence is a question or a statement of a fact. And Xavier Léon Dufour suggests, the question mark is in the wrong spot, but suggests that this second sentence is not a statement, it's a question. So Jesus, this confuses a lot of translators because Jesus seems to say, my hour has not yet come, I will not perform a miracle, I will not help, and then he turns around in the next verse and performs a miracle, which makes absolutely no sense. And Xavier Léon Dufour suggests the phrasing should be, has my hour not yet come? Jesus, in this case, would be saying, Mary, we are not on the same wavelength. Do you not know that I am about to intervene, that I am about to reveal something? I am about to help this couple. So Jesus here is hinting to his mother, I am about to do something very important and something that requires Mary to think. He is telling her, you have to look at this event carefully because I will be revealing something about myself. In the Gospel of John, the phrase, the hour, is a very important one. It's the hour where Jesus reveals himself as the Savior of humanity, as the Messiah. In particular, it's the hour where he is crucified and is risen from the dead. And so what Jesus is doing here is today we would talk about a trailer. Jesus is giving Mary and the disciples a glimpse of this hour, a glimpse of this revelation. He is about to start revealing himself to his disciples as the Son of God. So the Justin Donner translation of the sentence would be, Jesus said to her, woman, you do not know what you are saying. Has my hour not already come? Has the time not come for me to reveal my glory to my people? Verse 5. His mother said to the servants, do whatever he tells you. Mary, at least, seems to have understood that Jesus is about to do something. He is about to ask the servants to do something. She's not sure what Jesus is going to do. She's not sure what he is trying to reveal about himself. She's not necessarily aware of what Jesus has planned to do in this situation, but she's understood Jesus is going to do something. Jesus is not indifferent to the need of this couple, and Jesus is not indifferent to the needs of his people. And in a sense, Mary embodies the people of Israel in this passage, because Israel also doesn't know what the Son of God has planned. Israel also does not know how God is going to intervene and save them. And yet they have the same challenge as Mary. They have to trust in Jesus. They have to do what Jesus tells them. They have to trust that he knows how he is going to fulfill his Father's purpose. Verses 6 and 7. Now there were 6 stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water," and they filled them up to the brim. Jesus here is not performing a magic trick. He is going, at this point it's symbolic, but symbolically he is inviting the people of Israel to the Messianic feast. By turning this water into wine, he is showing them that he has brought joy for his people, that he is inviting them to the feast of the Lamb of God. John explains that there are 6 of these stone jars that the Jews use for their rites of purification. When John mentions a detail, it's not innocent. He's trying to explain something. Jesus does not use any random jug that he finds in the kitchen. He is using the jars that the Jews use for their rituals. 7 in biblical symbolism is the number of perfection. In the book of Revelation, the Lamb of God has 7 horns. That shows he has perfect power. He has perfect strength. Nothing is more powerful than him. A 6 is a failed 7. It's something that tries to be perfect, but never quite reaches perfection. These 6 stone jars should light up a little light bulb in our brains. There's something in the rites of purification of Israel, of the Old Testament, that is missing. The Old Testament, the law of Moses, tries to reach perfect purity and never quite makes it. There's always something imperfect, something missing. Israel cannot be pure with these 6 jars that they use for their rites. In the same way, without the intervention from the Son of God, we can never quite reach perfect purity. The size of these jars is also mentioned by John. Once again, it's not a random detail that John mentions. This water that is poured in the jars, that is matches about 800 bottles of wine. When Lisha and I got married, we had one wedding, one ceremony in Europe. I bought 20 bottles of wine for all our guests, and that was way too much. We had wine left over for months. 800 bottles, that's not enough for one wedding. That's enough for 40 weddings. That is enough wine for the next generation to use at their wedding. Exactly, it's a party. Jesus brings an overabundance of wine. Cana is not that big a town. They don't need that much wine. Jesus brings more than they need. He is wanting to fill them with a joy that spills over. A joy that they can barely measure. The wine that Jesus brings is not only better than the old wine of the old covenant. It's a wine like the prophets had promised to Israel that flows down the mountains. God gives his people a joy in abundance, more than they will ever need. And the wine that Jesus brings to his people is a very high-quality wine. That's something that's mentioned later in the passage. It is the best wine they have had at that wedding. I'll bring that up. Verse 8. He said to the servants, "Draw some out and take it to the master of the feast." So they took it. When the master of the feast tasted the water now become wine and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." You have kept the best wine until the end of the feast. Once again, John is mentioning this detail because it's significant on a spiritual level. The wine that Jesus brings is the best. The joy that he offers to the people of God has not been matched throughout Israel's history. Nobody has brought joy to God's people in the way that Jesus has. The man who says this to the bridegroom is simply talking of the wine he's holding in a cup. He's talking about the drink. He's not thinking about a spiritual meaning to his words. But John is mentioning that. He is quoting him to show this spiritual reality. Jesus has given this young couple the best wine they will ever have. And in the same way, he gives his church an overabundance of joy. He gives us a greater joy than we could experience anywhere else. And so a good summary for this miracle, what Jesus is trying to illustrate, is God saved the best for last. God saved the greatest joy for the coming of his son. The excellent wine of Christ replaces the bland water of the Old Testament, of the Old Covenant. Jesus fulfills something that the law cannot even dream about. He fills his church with blessings that the Old Testament could not even imagine. And I think that's a good lesson for us. I think in the Western world, our churches have focused a lot on doctrinal questions or moral questions. How should our services go? How should we interact with the culture around us? Those are all really good questions. I'm a theology major. I will talk about those things for hours if you want me to. But they're not the core of our faith. They are not what binds us to God. In the end, what Jesus came to bring us is joy. That is something we must not forget. Jesus is offering us not a new law, not a new philosophy, not a new moral law to follow. He is offering us a joy that we will find nowhere else. He is offering us the pure and unadulterated joy of fellowship with his Father. He is offering us joy that flows down the hills like rainwater. Later in one of his letters, the Apostle Peter is writing to Christians who are being persecuted for their faith. And he says, though you have not seen him, that this is Christ, though you have not seen Christ, you love him. And though you do not now see him, you believe in him and rejoice with joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory. Brothers and sisters, this is what God offers us, a joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory. The joy of being sons and daughters of God, the joy of living in fellowship with the Creator of our universe. Amen.
Thanks for listening to this week's sermon. The Beamsville Church of Christ meets Sunday mornings at 4900 John Street, Beamsville, Ontario. We have classes for all ages at 9:30, and the worship service begins at 10:30. You can subscribe to podcasts through Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music Store, or your favorite podcast app. Just search for Beamsville. All our past sermons and more information about our congregation are available at beamsvillechurchofchrist.ca.